copies of the bill. They will be available sometime on Monday, April 13th. The staff will do the very best they can to get it out as soon as possible, and we just don't have a time certain. And then it will also go to members of the minority party. And then, as you know, we're hearing the bill, walking through it on Tuesday, April 14th, the day that we come back at the usual time and place. And then on Wednesday, when we mark up the bill and do the amendments, we have a different room. We'll be in room 5, and we'll be there at 1:45 instead of 2:45. And that's because the Finance Committee wants to meet after us, and they think if we start sooner, then we will be done sooner. We will go from 1:45 on Wednesday the 14th until we are done. So however long we want to take. So those are the announcements. Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just, Madam Chair, a point of clarification, and I do know and appreciate your 24-hour rule on amendments. However, if we are walking through the bill on Tuesday at normal committee time and then actually marking up the bill the very next day, that's less than the 24 hours. Madam Chair, would it be your... with your approval that we have amendments at least the day before rather than a strict 24-hour interpretation?
Representative Biskins, I think because of that, I mean, obviously you and the members of the committee will have the bill in plenty of time, but the public won't. And if they have suggestions for us, I think we can be a little bit flexible. The Democrats are going over the amendments Tuesday night at 6:15. So just so we have them by then, I think we'd be in very good shape.
Appreciate your flexibility, Madam Chair.
Thank you for asking that, Representative Biskin. Okay, Representative Thiessen is here, and we do have a quorum. So Representative Thiessen, we'll do the minutes first while you're getting settled. Representative Depke, have you looked over the minutes of April 2nd?
Yes, I have.
Okay.
I move the amendments.
Representative Depke moves the minutes of April 2nd. Any discussion? All in favor say aye. Opposed?
Aye.
The motion prevails. The minutes for April 2nd are approved. Representative Thiessen, would you like me to move your bill, or did you ask a member?
I didn't ask anybody.
I will move House File 181 for... let's see, this is recommending to pass and go on to the Finance Committee. Is that correct, Representative?
I don't know if you go right to Health and Human Services, or you have to go back up.
We have to go back into Finance, and then they'll send it on to Health and Human Services. So this is going to Finance with the intention of going back to Health and Human Services. Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think we're here on 2 seconds of the bill, which start on page 2, line 3, and it's kind of subdivision 3 and subdivision 4. So on pages 2 and 3. And we actually do have an amendment, Madam Chair, that probably would speed things along.
Representative Thiessen, I will move the H01813 amendment. Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is language that we've been working closely with the Department of Education about how to accomplish what we want to do here in a more streamlined way, and it moves most of the work really out of the Department of Education, focusing on what they're already doing, which is sharing information from the schools over to the Department of Human Services. What this section of the bill will do on express lane eligibility is allow us actually to pull down substantially more federal dollars to cover, to get health care to kids, and I don't know if people want, so that's the first part of the amendment. The second part of the amendment is deleting some provisions that have caused some school districts some heartburn about a mandate of providing applications, et cetera, and about providing information to students about health care options for them. And we're taking out some of that language and refining it. So this is all language that's been worked out with the Department of Education. And the last part of the amendment is to make clear that we are paying for any work that the Commissioner of Education has to do out of the Health Care Access Fund.
And then, Representative Thiessen, we have this amendment before us, and it's my understanding you have an oral amendment to this amendment.
Actually, not on this amendment. It's to the bill. So
to the bill.
So if we could put this amendment on, and that's probably the cleanest way to do it. And then I do have an oral amendment to the bill that we can deal with later.
Okay. And before we have discussion on this amendment, members, this is here just for the sections that pertain to education. And for members who have been here long enough to remember Representative Benson's mandate reduction bill from last year, the lines 1.114 to 1.116 are actually something that Representative Benson attempted to do last year, and it did not pass, but it continues to fester with school districts, you know, being told by one committee what they have to do, and they have chafed at that. And so we appreciate that Representative Thiessen is now coming from the Health and Human Services Committee offering to delete that language and come up with something better, which has the side benefit of drawing down more federal dollars. While he's here and why we've had him working so hard with the Department of Education is because while we want to get rid of that mandate, we want all the federal dollars we can get. We also don't want any new mandates that aren't funded for the Department of Education or for school districts. And so Representative Thiessen is well aware of that and has been working very hard for the last couple days to make sure that doesn't happen. And so I told him we'll vote on this amendment, we'll do his next amendment, we'll hear about the bill, take questions and any testimony, and we have Lisa Barnridge from the department to tell us, to verify that the department has no concerns, and then we will hear from the school districts, and if all of that is accurate, we'll send you on your way, and if not, I told him we would send him to a corner to work everything out, because we're coming back to this bill then hopefully today, so I hope that's what we can do. So with that, are there any questions then on the A3 amendment? All in favor then say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Amendment is adopted. Your oral amendment, Representative Thiessen.
There's actually two of them. One is quick. It's on line 3.12.
Okay. Line 3.12.
It should eliminate the word of at the end of that line.
Striking of at the end of 3.12. Okay.
So that makes the amendment we just did actually fit.
Okay.
Okay.
All right.
So if you just want to do that one.
Right. All in favor of that amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Thiessen.
And now this is an oral amendment that I'm going to read, and I'm sorry for the late piece, but we've been working on this right up to right now. And so starting on line 2.9. You'll see the word, we're going to delete the words tied to.
Delete tied to.
And add and insert coordinated with.
And insert coordinated with.
Okay. And then on line
2.10.
After the word system, insert a period.
After system, insert period.
And strike the words including pre-kindergarten programs.
And strike including pre-kindergarten programs.
And since there's a period there, maybe we don't have to strike the period, but you guys can figure that out. Okay. On line two.
We're striking a comma, though, so.
Oh, is that a comma there? Okay. I'm sorry, yeah. And then on line 2.18.
2.18.
Strike the word, what? Strike the word two.
Strike the word two on 2.18.
And then on 2.19, after the parenthetical I, insert the word two.
After on 2.19, insert the word two after parenthetical I.
On 2.21, after parenthetical II, insert the word for the Commissioner of Human Services to.
On 2.21, after the small I's, insert for the Commissioner of Human Services to.
Right. So that's just clarifying, it's going to be the Commissioner of Human Services that's enrolling, not.
We like that.
Yeah. No, I would imagine you do. And then on
2.22,
the first commissioners should now become singular, so it would say Commissioner of Human Services.
Singular Commissioner on 2.22.
And then strike the word and insert the words in coordination with the Commissioner of.
And then insert and put insert in coordination with the Commissioner
of. And so of education. Mm-hmm. So say in coordination with the Commissioner of Education.
Okay. We could repeat those or we could not repeat those. How many members want those repeated?
Please no.
All right. Any discussion then on this oral amendment? Normally we don't have this long of oral amendments, but as Representative Thiessen said, he has been working up until shortly before this committee. Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just two questions. Representative Thiessen, on the written, the A3 amendment, line 1.4, you instruct us already on page 3, line 12, to delete everything after the word who. So I'm wondering on the oral amendment why we needed to delete the word of on 3.12 when it was already deleted in your written amendment.
They just told me I needed to do that, so...
But let me just ask, we don't have Ms. Larson in this committee. Does any of our staff know if we need that of or not?
I think Larson's business is right, but it's struck already, so...
Okay, okay. Good catch. Your second question.
My second question, thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Thiessen, is as long as we are clarifying, if you look on the bill, page 2, line 4, after parenthetical A, you have the words the commissioner and local agencies, yet within that subdivision we're talking about two commissioners in at least one place. We need to clarify which commissioner we're talking about after parenthetical A.
And Representative,
Madam Chair, we could say it's human service. It's in 256. Chapter 256, so I think it's presumed that it's the Commissioner of Human Services, but if we want to clarify that, I'm fine with that.
With that explanation, I'm comfortable, Madam Chair.
Representative Thiessen, I think you get the gist of this committee.
Yeah.
Representative Thiessen.
So can we move that to...
I'm sorry. Minute? Yes. That, any other questions or discussion on the oral amendment? If not, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The oral amendment is adopted. Representative Thiessen.
Okay, Madam Chair, just... to explain a little bit more, the express lane eligibility, what we're doing in that section now is saying that a free and reduced lunch form that you fill out is actually considered an application for health insurance as well. And then it would go to the Department of Human Services and they would deal with all the other eligibility stuff. But that allows us under federal law to kind of streamline things, and we're trying to do two things with one form, basically. And that's the gist of that provision. And then the open enrollment and streamlined application, this is more of the Department of Human Services, and it's important, I think, that we actually are consulting with the Commissioner of Education on this, because we're trying to come up with a process. You know, we have an open enrollment process for ourselves in October and November where we kind of renew our insurance each year, and what we'd like to do is kind of build a similar time around school time for kids when they have to renew their public program, because at the time people are thinking about filling out forms, etc. So that's the goal with that idea, and we want the Commissioner of Education to be there so we don't impose huge burdens on the school district. It's more, I think, going to be about the timing of doing it at that time than having it done, you know, necessarily in the schools, I think. But that, all this Section 3 is really asking us to do is to come up with a plan to accomplish that. And we have learned that in other places that focus on that kind of back-to-school time associated with renewal of these programs, we actually... teach people, and what that avoids, it doesn't even avoid necessarily getting more or less people on, although I think we'll get more kids on, but what it really avoids is the churning of people coming in and falling off and coming in and falling off, which costs us a ton of money to no purpose. So that's what the language does.
Thank you very much. And now we have testimony. If you could identify yourself, please.
Madam Chair, thank you. My name is Carol Spector. I'm the Legislative Affairs Director for Children's Defense Fund, Minnesota. I'm primarily here because I've been working with Representative Thiessen and the department on working through the language, but I would just support everything Representative Thiessen said. These are strong best practices, and they would help draw down federal dollars and save the state money on training.
And Madam Chair, I'd like to thank for actually working out this language more than me. So
thank you to both of you. Thank you, Ms. Spector. And we love it when things get worked out and we don't have to have a mess here. So I appreciate that very, very, very much.
Thank you.
We have the department, so it's truth time. We have Lisa Barnridge to come down and verify that the department is fine with this. Barnridge, you've become. Please state your name correctly and give us your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representatives. My name is Lisa Barnidge, and don't worry, I get lots of different names ever since I got married. So, yes, I do appreciate this. The department would like to just say that we do appreciate Representative Thiessen and the Children's Defense Fund for bringing us in on this conversation. We feel that hopefully the way that we've been able to work out this language, it wouldn't be an extra burden to the school districts. We're just using our current process to help identify children who could receive medical assistance.
Thank you so
Thank
much.
Thank you.
That's what we'd like to hear. Any testimony for or against the bill from anyone else? Hearing none, and I don't see any more questions from members. Very one, Representative Biskin. Yes,
thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Thiessen, I do appreciate the streamlining. Help me understand, if you could, the verification process that takes place. Families can fill out a form, but how then is that form verified? Because verification is very important. As you know, there are state and federal dollars tied to the identification of free and reduced lunch students.
Representation.
Madam Chair and Representative Biskin, and I think the last point you made is that there are particularly federal requirements around verification. The Department of Human Services will be doing that. Really what will be happening is this form will be transferred from the school to the Department of Education over to the Department of Human Services, but then they will process it as they would any other application and verify everything that they would need to verify. So that end of the process won't really change.
Madam Chair, thank you, Representative Thiessen. I appreciate that. I would hope that the verification information, which may be even more stringent in the Department of Health and Human Services, is then transferred back to the Department of Education so they can verify whether or not the child is truly indeed eligible for free and reduced lunch.
Representative Thiessen.
That's really up to you guys. You all. But I would say, I mean, the one thing that we are saving time on here is that the eligibility for free and reduced lunch is actually under the eligibility for our public programs. And so the income varied eligibility, that's where we have savings, because we do the eligibility in one place instead of two is the goal here.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Thiessen, I haven't seen a fiscal note on this yet. Could you explain to me how the costs are going to be covered on this program?
Madam Chair, there is a provision in one of the amendments that the Department of Education side is going to be covered out of the Health Care Access Fund, and now we're going back to Health and Human Services Finance to figure out how and if we can pay for this whole thing out of that budget.
Thank you.
Thank you. There are no more questions. Oh, there is. Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Chief, I know it's not the purview of this committee, but I was reading this last night, Section 16, the repealer. Even though it's not the purview of this committee, I'm just curious what that is, because a senior member once told me to always read the repealers, and I can't understand what that means.
And it is not the purview of this committee, but as you know, Representative Garofalo, repealers are listed, and it is on 1R, the repealer page, but you want to have some more information about it?
Representative Thiessen, the Health and Human Services part of my brain is very, very small, so don't open up on me and throttle me with too much information. I'm just wondering if you can kind of explain to me what that means, because I read it a couple of times, and I actually didn't know what it meant.
Representative Thiessen, like a 30-second explanation, because this is not in the jurisdiction of this committee. Or Ms. Spector.
Madam Chair and Representative Garofalo, the way I understand this language is that we had sought a federal waiver, and I believe it wasn't granted at some point under federal law. So I think it's actually eliminating some unnecessary language. But I will get back to you for sure on that.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
That's less than 30 seconds.
Now there are no more questions. I will renew my motion that House Bill 181 be sent back to Finance Committee with the intention of going back to Health and Human Services. And all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The motion prevails, and the bill is passed to, as amended, to the Finance Committee. Thank you. Representative Marquardt. Is not here. Representative Biskins is all warmed up. Why don't we do that? Auditor Otto, I think we'll have you do your presentation while the pages try to round up Representative Marquardt. Members, in your packet, you have a special study. When we had Auditor Otto here last time on this topic, she offered kindly to do a study for us, and actually had a very rapid turnaround, and that is what the special study is before us on the post-employment benefit liabilities of school districts. So we appreciate greatly that he was able to do this for us, and we would like to hear what he found out. Welcome, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Rebecca Otto, and I'm the Minnesota State Auditor. And I'm so happy to return to your committee to give you a little bit of an update. Now I'm going to switch chairs, but I'm going to drive them out.
Okay. Okay.
Excuse me. All right. So it isn't easy to get a survey done in a short period of time, typically with entities. So we had to keep the survey short and sweet. And we wanted to try to give you guys a 30,000-foot view of what's going on with SPL studies being done for school districts and the bonding activity that has occurred to hopefully help inform your decisions as we work on these issues. And my computer is almost ready, so I wanted to, I'm a visual person, so I'm trying to give you the easy visual. So that you probably, I believe, have a copy of the special study in front of you. I'm going to kind of cover the highlights, do a quick review of, of what OPEB is. So I'm going to go ahead and start without it. Reminder, because I'm sure you don't have it memorized yet. OPEB means Other Post-Employment Benefits and consists mainly of health care benefits promised to public employees upon their retirement. So it's not pensions. And Minnesota Statute 471.61 allows for local government entities to provide retiree health care. All right, and then a quick review of GASB. It's Government Accounting Standards Board, and they decided with Statement 45 that the financial statements of a public entity must disclose OPEB liability. And you almost there? All right, so technology does not work.
Yeah,
me.
We have to warm up the horse before
one
we
other, yeah, I know. One other important aspect, too, of GASB to understand before we go over the highlights of our special study is that different government entities were phased in at different times. So phase one entity would be have revenues of over $100 million. Phase two, which is a little bit later implementation of GASB 45, was between $10 and $100 million revenues. And then phase three are governments that are $10 million or less. And so not all entities, when we surveyed, have had their actuarial study done. So that will impact our numbers. And the OPEB special study that basically examines the extent to which school districts in Minnesota have undertaken actuarial studies regarding their OPEB liability and the numbers of districts utilizing the authority provided in Statute 471.6175 and 475.52, so Division 6, to create trust and issue bonds, which you passed into law last session. I apologize. Can we pause for one moment? I worked so hard on that.
Our technology that's slow, I guess.
I know.
If it's going to be a while, we could have Representative Marquardt move his bill if you want to, Representative Marquardt, and do the amendment, and then maybe they'll be ready by then. Sure, if you want to start out from there, and then when they get done, you can go up there. But why don't you just move your bill, and then we'll do the amendment and get your bill in shape, and then hopefully technology will catch up with us. Representative Marquardt.
Very good. Thank you very much, Madam Chair. I'll move House File 2224 for possible inclusion into the final report.
Representative Marquardt moves House File 2224 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. And to your amendment, Representative Marquardt.
Madam Chair, I'd like to move the A2 amendment.
Representative Marquardt moves the A2 amendment. Representative Marquardt.
Madam Chair and members, what the A2 amendment does is extend the effective date to August 1st of 2009.
Any questions on the amendment changing the March date to August 1st? Hearing none. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Now we got Representative Garofalo down there is sure to be soon ready, right?
Absolutely.
And so we have tech support now.
Well, Representative Marquardt, why don't you tell us about your bill, and then we'll see if they're ready after that. Representative Marquardt.
Very good. Well, thank you very much, Madam Chair, and the state auditor, I know, would cover most of this, and so I'm not going to go over what other post-employment benefits are, but in earlier reports, the Office of Legislative Auditor said there was about $3.3 billion of outstanding liabilities when it came to these accounts, and that does not include the implicit rate subsidy, which, as I was listening to Representative Viskin today earlier in tax committee, this is actually Act 2, Madam Chair, it looked like that could be possibly about 30%. You could maybe add on to that. So we really have a problem with this, and because we have huge liabilities, and as the state auditor mentioned with GASB Statement 45, is now there has to be transparency, which means entities have to be able to list and say what are these liabilities and so forth. So last year, in 2008, we did a few things to try to address this, and one was to give or create authorities for municipalities to not only determine what their OPEB liability was, but also to allow them to establish trusts to put dollars into. Right now, up to this point, school districts and that was pretty much a pay-as-you-go. And then with this law last year, we also allowed them to bond for what their liabilities were. And you could bond without voter approval. So that's what we did last year. On January of this year, January 26th, we held a joint tax and education committee. And I think we have some unintended consequences. And one of the major unintended consequences is that we think we weren't getting a level playing field in that there's about, up till December, there's about 30 school districts that had bonded. And now, according to testimony today, according to the Department of Revenue, it's up to about 43 school districts that have bonded for this. They sold and issued bonds of about $350 million, and leading to a property tax levy of about $27 million a year. So anyway, one of the things we found out they're using the funds for, in testimony, was to supplant some of the dollars that normally would go towards maybe the pay-as-you-go here. They were using some of this bond money to, for example, pay for all-day, every-day kindergarten. And I think that was, at least it struck me that day, that it really created a real equalization issue, in that if you're going to bond for this and you're able to apply it into normal educational classroom things, this is going to create some real inequities. The other real concern I had from what we did last year is that there could be a huge explosion of property tax increases. And I could see that coming down the road, and I think that's a real policy question as to what could ultimately happen here, Madam Chair and members, is that with this, what I see happening is you could see a lot of the dollars going into the classroom being reduced, or at least some great competition with these OPEB benefits. And so not only having a decrease in the caliber of what you're going to see in the classroom, but also huge property tax increases. And so this bill tries to address that. And another concern was the transparency. I think the bill that we have here, 2224, is going to increase the transparency as we look at this issue. So, Madam Chair, what this bill does is probably three main things. It does create a new levy authority, which did not exist before. And it's not an increase in property taxes, I want members to know, because it's a capped levy. And it's a capped levy, and what we capped it to was what would be the property taxes expected from what we did in 2008. So if you have already what has been levied to pay for bonds and what would be anticipated over the future, what we've done is we've capped it to those numbers. And Mr. Strom can explain that more, but basically once we hit 2012, there would be about a $19 million increase a year, and that's about what numbers are showing under current law, what would be the property tax levy. So we do cap that. So let's say there was $100 million out there in projected levies for these bonds, but we only had, $19 million or a total of 50 or whatever, you'd have to proportionately reduce that down to the 50%. So as folks levied, they'd have to stay within this cap, and the commissioner would determine what that is and put that down. Now, if they go to this levy, one other really important thing is that there would have to be a sunset, which means basically at a certain date in their newest contracts, they would have to say this is an end date, either for those who retire prior to a certain date could get in, but after that they could not, or employees hired before a certain date could get in, and after that they could not. So this would somewhat close the barn door and not let a lot more horses out, and I think that would at least, as far as property taxes increases and that, would stem some of that. And then I guess the third main point of the bill is that now if you wanted to bond for these OPEB benefits, you would now have to take it to a vote of the people. It'd have to be a referendum, which I think would greatly increase the transparency and allow property owners to know exactly where these funds are going. Now, I have to say there's been a number of entities that have already addressed their contracts throughout the state in trying to address this huge problem. But, you know, when you look at it, there are 7 school districts right now that their OPEB liabilities are more than twice the amount of their annual revenue. And there are 4 school districts that their OPEB liability is 5 times over what their annual revenue is. So, members, we have a problem with this, and I think this bill is a compromise to try to address those concerns.
Thank you, Rep. Marquardt, for bringing this bill forward, and so we can have this discussion. And it looks like we'll take a break now before we go to questions on the bill and get more educated on the size of the problem that that our auditor has studied for us. Auditor Otto.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I apologize for technological glitch, and I really appreciate Representative Garofalo. I have a newfound respect for you, Representative Garofalo.
He comes in handy every now and then.
Take a look at
you. Madam Chair, even a broken clock is right twice a day, right?
I'm
referring to Auditor Otto, not
me. Oh, you.
Okay,
well, I was referring to you, and I think she was, too. Auditor Otto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So in our survey, again, we didn't give school districts a lot of time, but they really tried to get back to us. So of the, we surveyed 342, and of that, 274 responded, which is quite an excellent response rate, 81%. And of the number of districts that had an actuarial evaluation of OPEB liability, there were 119, about 35%, and they all had AAL, which you will see in a moment what that is. And then the number of respondents that issued bonds was 33 at that time. Now, I know there's 4 districts that Department of Ed had identified as issuing bonds that did not respond to the survey, so they're not included in here. But this still gives you the 30,000-foot view of what's going on. I hope you can see the table. This table is in your study on page 3, if you want to see it a little bit more closely. So this table is the top 25 actuarial accrued liability amounts for school districts. This is a big number. And we simply ranked it by the total dollar amount of AAL. And so St. Paul is number 1, Minneapolis is 2, Hibbing 3, Grand Rapids 4, and you go on down the line. Now that number really is not in context. So if we go to table 3, which is should be on page 4 of your study, if you want to see that more closely, this is the annual required contribution, the ARC, as a percent of total operating revenue. Just begins to put it in perspective for you. So the ARC is a percent of 2008 operating revenues. Hibbing is number 1. It's 19.5% of their operating revenues. Mesabi East is number 2 at 13.5%. Grand Rapids is number 3. Virginia, it's quite a few of the Iron Range schools in that list at the top. And St. Paul is down at number 9. So again, this puts it into perspective for you.
Madam Chair?
Representative
Abney. Madam Auditor, if that's the right way to address you.
It is. All right. Good. Then we're covered on the protocol question, at least.
You're raising the issue of context, which is one that I struggled with as I glanced over your report. Is it of value to ask what the accrued liability is on a per student basis, on a student count basis, some of the funding measures that we use here, would that not give us a better sense? Because the big dollars, you know, are shocking, but how many kids is that being spent out over might also be a context that's of value, unless I'm wrong. And if there's either Madam Auditor or someone else from the department, from her administration, could answer that.
President Dabney, we are all in your debt. It's easier to say Madam Auditor than Auditor Otto. Madam Auditor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. There are certain people I may call me Madam Auditor, and then you call me Auditor Otto. No, I'm just kidding. No, either works. Some people have a hard time saying Auditor Otto. So. Madam Chair, Representative Dabney, I would say that there's many ways to slice and dice this to put it into perspective, and I think I had our auditors in the room, you had legal and auditors and all kinds of folks trying to get the fairest representation and putting it in perspective. So you could probably do it on our pay students as well. We did it based on their revenue simply because this is a dollar and cents matter for them, and it's trying to figure out how they're going to fund it over the long term. And for some of them, when you look at their ARC as a percent of 2008 operating revenues, it gives you a sense of how much that really is for them, and it's, for some of them, very substantial. So that's one way we put it into context for you. We could have done it other ways, and if we do this again in the future, I'd be happy to find out from you what you'd like to see, because that is another way to do comparisons.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. And so, Table 4, I'll bring to your attention, that would be now on page 5 of your report, and this one, we looked at the OPEB bonds issued. These districts have issued bonds, and this is OPEB bonds as a percent of the actuarial accrued liability. That's the big number for school districts. And what's interesting there is Minnetonka is number one. The value of their OPEB bonds as a percent of AAL is 125%. We did, our researcher did contact the Department of Education to try to determine why it was so far over 100. We weren't really able to get a definitive answer. They may have gotten a new valuation and had different numbers, but that's not what they reported to us, so I'm sorry, I can't tell you why that is. Someone else may be able to shed some light on that. But as you can see, some of them are issuing those valuable type bonds as a percent of AAL, close to 100, a little bit over. Some of them are under. So this is the data we have to this point. There is one column there called, of the AAL, amount attributable to implicit rate subsidy. And implicit rate subsidy, some districts are not paying for retiree health care, but by state law, they have to offer it if they're offering it to active employees. And so retirees cost more than the active, and so there's an implicit rate subsidy there. So that's something that is included in their actuarial work, and some of them are bonding for that. And finally, in summary, for those school districts that had an actuarial evaluation conducted that answered our survey, the amount of the actuarial accrued liability, or AAL, is $1.4 billion. The amount of the AAL attributable to the implicit rate subsidy is $516.9 million. The annual required contribution is $133.2 million. The net OPEB obligation, which I have not even discussed with you, there's terminology in the back of the report, if you can see what that is $106 million. And finally, 33 school districts issued $337.3 million in bonds to fund their AAL of $337.4 million. So again, it's a 30,000-foot view of what's going on out there currently. I will make note that Representative Marquardt referred to the study that OLA put out around this. We also, our office before I was there, issued one. I was looking at the estimated numbers in those old reports compared to the actual.
Yeah.
Some of them are in half. They're not even close to what they estimated. They're much lower. And so we still don't have a handle on the actual numbers. We're getting closer to school districts. So I hope this is helpful to you, and we'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you very much. I think very helpful. Question from members. Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, Madam Auditor, perhaps you can help me understand the logic behind the Gadsby 45 rule, particularly when it comes to the implicit rate subsidy. Now, I'm going to try and simplify this again, all right? If, because of our state law, retirees have to be able to buy into the pool, there is no state law that says that the public entity has to actually pay for them to purchase. This is all out of the this could be all out of the retiree's own pocket. So there's actually no state dollars at all. However, because they can purchase into the pool at $300 a month, whereas because of their age, they might have to, on the market, it might cost them $500 a month. The public school now has to carry $200 a month for that individual. Do I have this right, the implicit rate subsidy?
Please identify yourself.
David Kenny, State Auditor's Office. It's not only that the open market would do that, but the actual cost, the premiums that are being set by the insurance company to cover your active employees are being adjusted to include retirees. And because the premium is the same across the board, GASB considers that to be a subsidy of those employees.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. And this might be a question then to the author of the bill. Maybe he knows this, or maybe the auditor does. Is it my understanding then that while the school district has to show this implicit rate subsidy on their books, while it may not be actually any money coming out of their pocket, we now, in current state law, do allow them to sell bonds for this obligation that they don't really even have coming out of their pocket. Is that current state law, Representative Marquardt?
Representative Marquardt.
Yeah, Representative Biscuits. I don't know. Maybe Mr. Strom could answer that than I can. Yeah. That'd be all right.
Madam Chair, Representative,
right
now the current state law is that any district that goes
through
July...
I don't think people can hear you.
Oh,
you get your mic.
Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members, under the current state law, which was passed in 2008, the school district, after performing the actuarial study, may then go and issue bonds for the amount of both the implicit subsidy and the outstanding retiree health benefits costs that exist. So the current law allows that, and those are the 33 districts that have done that so far, as of the Pay 09 levy, and another 10 we understand have subsequently sold bonds.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And you know, Representative Biscombe kind of mentioned that I'm confused about this implicit rate subsidy with where they're not paying for it. I think I'm just going to let that go, and we'll talk about it later. Representative Marquardt, on page 1, on line 22, you had mentioned the phrase closing the barn door. I just want to make sure I understand this right, that is, to qualify for this, it would have to have either sunsetted these sort of benefits or write them into a new bargaining agreement to sunset that? Is that correct?
Representative Marquardt.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Garofalo, that is correct. And technically, there is no definition of sunset clause. But according to the department, for example, this would be an acceptable sunset clause if it's indicating at some point no retirees will receive health benefits after they retire. For example, as I mentioned before, if you have a date set, where employees who retire prior to a certain date, or if you have a date set where employees hired before a certain date, would receive it, and some would, you have to have a specific date, but it would be in a current contract.
Okay, and
Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Marquardt. Would this, for going forward, would this eliminate the bonding and just replace it with the pay goal, or are both still going to be in place? But again, going forward.
Yes,
Representative Marquardt.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo. If you wanted to bond now, you would have to have a vote. And if you do go through the referendum, that one division, subdivision two here, that paragraph B would not apply. Then you would not have to sunset.
Okay.
It's only if you set up the new levy would you have to sunset.
Okay, so there's two sets of rules, then, one for bonding, one for levying.
Okay.
If you want to bond, you must, and nod of the head is okay, you don't have to respond, but if you want to bond, you have to have voter approval. If you want to levy, you
let
don't have to.
Let the record show a nod of the head. Marquardt.
Thank you, and Madam Chair, Representative Marquardt. And then, if you want to levy, you would not need voter approval, but you would require the sunset.
That is correct.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. two questions.
Representative Avenue, you can go for it. We're in good schedule today. We do have two more bills, but we're still in good schedule because they're shorter hearings.
I think the solution to how I was able to string out my two questions last week was if people didn't answer my questions, then I wouldn't have follow-up questions.
Representative Avenue, get into your first question.
All right. For Madam Auditor, I'm trying to understand Table 5. And what I'm not understanding, particularly the 1, 2, 3, fourth column, does the district have an OPEB liability? And this is just my confusion, and perhaps someone in the room can clarify it for me. Some of the districts are identified as having and others not having an OPEB liability. And yet my understanding is state law requires districts to allow retirees to purchase health care through the current employee pool, at which point the implicit rate subsidy means that everyone has an OPEB liability. And if I'm not understanding that correctly, can someone help me to better understand it, please?
Auditor Otto or Mr. Kinney?
Right, yep.
Auditor Otto.
Yes, Madam Chair and Representative Dabney. If they don't offer health care to active employees, they won't have an implicit rate subsidy. And so there are some on there that said no. Now, sometimes it's confusing when people answer our surveys, but there are a few no's. It could be they're not offering active health care, active employees health care, then therefore they don't have to offer retirees health care. So that's a possible answer for that.
We got an answer for that one. Question number two.
All right. Question number two is for the author of the bill. And I'm just struggling to understand. As I understand it, as Marquardt, the bill could be interpreted to encourage districts to sunset the language in their collective bargaining agreement. What is the advantage to that approach in your bill versus an approach that simply separates the two pools of employees into two separately dealt with health insurance pools, one for the current staff, one for retirees that are then, I don't have my vocabulary along today, but interpreted, assessed their rates differently and therefore eliminating the implicit rate subsidy.
Representative Marquardt.
Well, thank you very much, Madam Chair and Representative Daphne. You know, as mentioned earlier today, there was an effort to separate those two in a bill, and I think that might be the best way to go. It didn't happen. In fact, that probably was going to wind up in my property tax division report, but didn't quite make it there. I don't know if there's incentives one way or the other. I mean, if I had my brothers, I probably would separate those out, which would probably eliminate a lot of this implicit rate subsidy problem we have. But I don't know if I can answer your question as far as what would be an incentive or not.
Okay, Auditor Otto maybe has an answer.
Madam Chair, Representative Davenport, I did hear the debate in one committee. Some of the local governments have asked for that as a mandate relief.
Right.
And they wanted to separate the assets from the retirees, saying, well, that would help us because we wouldn't have that implicit rate subsidy. The debate that I heard, and I saw the language get stripped that allowed that from one bill because they were concerned that retiree health care would become out of reach for many retirees. And the one person who got it pulled out of committee was concerned that then there'd be more folks without health care in our state. And so that was the argument that I heard against that type of legislation.
Thank you. Two questions as advertised. Thank you,
Madam
Chair.
Are we on to what, number 5 now?
No. I asked two questions, I'm done.
Oh, you're done?
No,
I thought you were.
No, as advertised. Two questions. Thank you.
A man of your word.
Of course, I am.
Very good. And members, for those of us who aren't on the tax committee, as Representative Biskin said at the beginning of this hearing, this is part two of this drama. We had, which we didn't have, but the tax committee had part one, and I think that was even more high drama, perhaps, than what we are hearing today, and since or this afternoon, and since many of us weren't there, I think some of this is harder to follow than for those who are on the tax committee. But I think the important thing to know is that this opportunity for districts that they still consider an opportunity happened in, while there was a short stop here with this bill, it happened in the tax committee, and I think most people thought last session that this would be a cities and a counties thing, but because the municipalities label also includes school districts,
there was a short stop here, but lo and behold, the opportunity for this bonding was mostly taken advantage of by school districts, and now we're trying to get a rein on that, and that's kind of what we're doing today. Representative Detmer.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And for Madam Auditor, are there any districts out there now that are going away from the post-employment benefits, just concentrating more on the employees that are current at hand, or they have to follow up with the employees that have been on the post-employment benefits and with that contract, but are some of them going away from that?
Madam Auditor.
Madam Chair, Representative Detmer, I think you're referring to somebody's still paying for this retiree health care. Okay. I believe I heard Representative Marquardt make a comment about that. We did not survey on that because if we made our survey too long, we would not have gotten responses in time for your deadlines. Mm-hmm. And so we didn't get an update on that. I believe the OLA had done some follow-up, and I believe last time we were talking about this together, they were saying some had adjusted what they were offering. And I think now that everyone has the 3,000-foot view of what it means and the cost involved and how they're going to have to pay for it over time, that I would imagine they have cut back, but I can't confirm that with our survey.
Thank you very much. Is there any testimony for or against the bill? Mr. Dean. Thank you very, very much to Auditor Otto and to Mr. Kenning. Very much. This was helpful that you were able to do this study so fast and so well.
Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome, Mr. Deans, and please give us your testimony.
Madam Chair, my name is Tom Dean, and I'm legal counsel of the School Board Association, and I'll try to be brief, but this is kind of a confusing issue, so let me just go through a couple of parts so that you understand how some of this works. GASB 45 is a federal accounting standard that we're required to comply with that was adopted in 2004, and it did not start going into effect until 2008, and that was for the biggest municipalities and school districts, 2009 for the medium ones, in 2010 for the small ones. And some of those that may not have shown up on that list, or it may have said they didn't have any, they may not have had their actuarial reports done yet because they didn't have to, because it didn't apply to them yet. So, but anyway, this covers the accounting by political subdivisions that offer these benefits. Now, the covered benefits can include retiree health insurance, retiree dental insurance, retiree life insurance, retiree vision insurance, long-term care insurance, or similar insurances like that. Not everybody offers all of those. Some have it, some don't. Sometimes, it got into somebody's contract for 1 year because somebody wanted it or whatever. But those are the types of things that can be covered. And these are called the direct subsidized liabilities. And the amount that of the OPEB is determined by how much of the premium or the benefit is paid for by the school district. GASB 45 also includes this implicit rate subsidy. As you know, in school districts, because you have the rule of 90, and lots of school teachers begin working when they're 22, and by the time they get to be 57 or 58, they're eligible under the rule of 90 to retire. Then from the time that they retire until they get to be 65, they can stay in the pool. Even under the new bill that's going through, that I assume you'll see sooner or later here, they could retire at 62. The state law requires that they be in the same pool with the active employees and pay the same rate as the active. That's called a blended rate. Now, what that means is all of your active employees are subsidizing having those retirees in that pool. But for OPEB purposes, you determine how much are they paying and how much would they have been paid, would they be paying if they weren't pooled together with the active. And the difference between those is the implicit rate subsidy. So if they're paying $300 a month, and if they were pooled by themselves to be paying $600 a month, that $300 a month is the implicit rate subsidy. We have no way to get out of that implicit rate subsidy if we're offering health insurance. We have no way to get out of that. And I'm going to come back to that when we talk about the levy that Representative Mark Quartz got in here. GASB creates this implicit rate even if the employer pays 100% of the cost of those retire, or if the employee pays 100% of the cost. They do that calculation, and that's our liability no matter what. Representative Landing, in his mandate reduction bill, had a provision that would have eliminated that requirement that they be pooled. It got stripped along the way. The tax committee was pretty excited about this morning, so it may show back up. I don't know. That insurance would be more expensive for retirees, but it would be less expensive still because they'd still be in a group plan than it would be if you were buying it on the open market or if you were buying it through AMCHA or whatever. They'd still have a better deal than they would. The concept of GASB is that it's an accrual-based accounting. Employees earn the retirement benefit over the period of their employment, and then the benefits counted as included as a component of their annual compensation. This requires an analysis that has to be done by an actuary, and then it has to be redone every 2 or 3 years to determine how much that number is. The 2008 legislation allowed the creation of trusts to put money in that you were going to pay these OPEB benefits out of. The funds that are put in those trusts can be invested at a higher rate, just like a covered pension plan. And to the extent that you get a higher return on that rate that's in that trust, that means you will have to pay in less. You would levy less, you would bond less, because you would have the money there to pay these. The 2008 legislation also allowed the issuance of bonds to pre-fund these liabilities. To the extent they issue the bonds, the bond proceeds go in the trust. They can be invested at that higher level. You get that money there, and then it can be extended out over a number of years, and in theory, it will more than pay for itself, because they can invest those at a higher rate than you can if you just invest that money in CDs or whatever. School districts have no other specific source of revenue to pay for these OPEB liabilities. Cities and counties have a general levy authority that they can levy for whatever they need to. To the extent that cities and counties have already been levying for OPEB liability, that's in their base. Now, I know that their levies got capped last year, but if it's in their base, it doesn't get capped. And they already have that authority. Our people don't. To the extent that you eliminate the ability for us to get a source of revenue, then that money comes as straight cuts in the classroom or straight cuts somewhere within the system, as you know. I want to talk a little bit about the levy, but let me, I know,
okay, very,
I
know, very we have, quickly. We have two more people. Let me just ask, is there anyone else who wants to testify besides who we have up here? Okay, we'd like to finish up this hearing, if possible, in, 5 or 6 minutes.
Okay, the bond money, the proceeds of the bonds cannot be spent for anything other than paying for OPEB. I think the guy from Alexandria that testified on this, I think it was a little confusing for the committee. You can't take the OPEB proceeds and use them to pay for something else other than OPEB. You can use the money that you would have spent on that, but you can't take the OPEB proceeds. Let that be an item of confusion. In the bill, you've got a levy, and we appreciate the fact that you've tried to put a levy in to give us a source of revenue. If we have to have a sunset clause in effect for the current bargaining agreement, I would suggest that by the time we have to send these levies in for truth and taxation, which, the department sends the stuff out to get the deal, and we have to have that back in by September 30th, This year is like other years in history. We won't have our collective bargaining agreements done by then. We won't get to do that. It's just impossible to meet that timeline. What that means is that we won't have any source of revenue. Also, we can't sunset the implicit rate stuff. That's state law driven. We have it whether we want it or not, unless we terminate health insurance altogether. So I believe that the way this is drafted right now, and I would be glad to work with whoever, no one can qualify under this unless they either don't have any health insurance or unless they don't, unless it's odd. The other piece would be is the way this is set up with the cap on the levy. And I believe the cap is only on this levy, as I understand it, not on the debt service levies. But to the extent you have a cap, you wouldn't know at the time you said, you know, you would say, well, all right, we ours is $50,000 for this year. You'd put that in your thing. That's what you'd be budgeting for. You'd get the deal back from the department somewhere further down the line and find out, oh, by the way, you're only going to get the levy to $25,000 when they do the proration. And then you've got to come up with the rest of the money. We think that this is that this levy is the right idea if you want to give us a source of revenue. We just think that you've drawn it so restrictively that no one will be able to use it.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Deans. And Mr. Lundell, anything not what he already said, something new?
Madam Chair, just briefly, and I'll succeed at being brief.
You could restate your name.
Brad Lundell, School for Equity and Education. We've had several inquiries over the last few weeks, especially in the wake of the introduction of the bill. A number of districts that are very, very interested. I think that the change in the date from March to August should help with some of that. Everything Mr. Dean said is, you know, really summed up the concerns that we have. We want to work with the committee to make sure that this is something that is available, but then is also something that is not run rampant down the road.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, Scott Grunquist, with the Association of Metropolitan School Districts, and just wanted also to be on the record sharing the concerns that Mr. Dean outlined, and be happy to work with you and the committee members as you move forward. Thank you.
Madam Chair, can I just say one more thing on the effective date?
Something quickly now.
The effective date says that it applies, it's effective for obligations issued and sold prior to August 1. I just want to ask you if that means that the whole thing has to be delivered and everything by August 1. There's a time period between when you sell and when you deliver. It would be more helpful for us if it just said sold, so that if we've got the thing sold, we've entered into the contract, that would lock it there. Otherwise, you know, we're going to have to sell these in June or so in order to get it closed by August. So if it said sold, that would be more helpful.
Thank you very much. And I'm sure Representative Marquardt is perfectly willing to work with you as we go forward. Representative Marquardt, any closing comments?
Yeah, well, thank you very much. And I guess prior to 2008, there were no options. Yeah. And now we are providing schools either a levy or the bonding authority. And I think this is a good compromise. I think it's going to get a handle on these as far as future liabilities. It's transparent. It's going to keep property taxes in check. I think it's going to allow for more dollars into the classroom than otherwise would be. And you know, we can certainly work things out as we go forward on this bill.
Thank you very much, Mr. Marquardt. Renews his motion for House File 2222 to be laid over for possible 2224. I'm looking right at it and can't say it right. After all this, to be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Representative Swale.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Marquardt. Nice job with a complicated issue. Bring it back to taxes. You're still going, my goodness. Representative Swale.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I would like to move House File 2183 for possible inclusion in the education omnibus bill.
Representative Swale moved House File 2183 for possible inclusion. Representative Swale.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and this is a project that is very important to me personally. I served as the board chair of the Woodbury Community Theater about 15 years ago. And at that time, we had a long-range plan developed, and in that long-range plan, one of the most important things that we discussed was having a home of our own. We have constantly had to share the stage of the local high school and have run into a lot of problems over the years with scheduling, not being able to have the kind of full schedule that a community theater likes to have. So what we have before us in this particular bill is simply this. We would like to request that that dollars be appropriated from the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act of 2009. And we are hoping that we are able to be able to compete for a grant from the federal government in order to complete the Performing Arts Center in Woodbury, which would be attached to the new East Ridge High School. Now, I've just passed out to you a kind of a blueprint of what that facility would look like. The new high school will open this fall. The auditorium is already built, and that will be a wonderful facility for the high school. But what the Center for the Arts is hoping for is a black box theater, an art gallery, and just storage for sets and costumes that would just really amplify the access that the community arts or the art center has in our community. I have with me two members from Arts Connection. I know that Chair Grayling said that she didn't want any testifiers, but they are here to help answer any questions. But I do want to make a statement, and that is that I have been looking forward to hearing what the Department of Education might be providing us in terms of the Finance Committee on ways that we can apply for those funds that will be available through the stimulus package that's coming out. And perhaps some of you have heard, maybe Mr. Strom or Mr. Crow know what the provisions in the federal recovery money might be, but we have yet to hear any suggestions here in this committee about how to apply for those funds. This is a shovel-ready, I hate that phrase, but it is a shovel-ready project. The blueprints are drawn. There was complete hope and belief that this would be a finished product when the high school opens in next fall in 2009. And so I am hoping that we are able to have some sort of guidance on how to be able to apply for that grant, and so that's why we have the bill before us. This is Michelle Witte. She is a board member of Arts Connection from Woodbury, and perhaps if you don't mind, Madam Chair, she might be able to make a statement.
Ms. Witte, a short statement.
Thank you, Madam Chairman and Representative Swales. Again, we think this project especially is timely given the goals of the Economic Stimulus Program to both provide a shovel-ready project for the community to extend the building that's currently going on at East Ridge. Also will not create any new operating dollars for the school district because it is a collaborative project. We do have donor money for operating the facility once it's up. So it's a strong, collaborative, fiscally sound way to put an art center to benefit all the students of South Washington County and the East Metro area. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you very much, and thank you for being here. And if you want to state your name and a sentence or two as well.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. Dan Matthews. I'm a board member with the Arts Connection also. I've been involved in this opportunity to get an arts center in the South Washington County area for many years now, and we're very excited to be collaborating with the school district, and I think you have letters from the superintendent that talk about that collaboration and how excited they are to have us collaborating with them to work side by side with students in the district. And so we're hoping that you will let us move forward with this project.
Thank you very much. And what we're, you know, in addition to hearing about this very good project, we're also, like Representative Wells, interested to find out how we can use this bill to find out a little more about the opportunities for districts with some of this stimulus money. So I think we'll ask Mr. Strom or Mr. Crow to tell us what they know. And while they're doing that, if we could have Ms. Weber come forward, and we'll pick her brains as well. Do either of you,
Madam
Mr.
Chair,
Strom.
Members, on the front page of the bill summary, there's a list of the major categories of money that can be allocated for out of the federal stimulus money. And you can see there in that federal stabilization fund, there's a great deal of money in that fund. It's my expectation that if the House targets that were adopted stay in force, that all $817 million of that will be committed per those targets. So then essentially what's going to be remaining is the money in the various grant programs. And perhaps Ms. Weber or others from the department could tell us what they know about those grants. There's a lot less information about those grant programs. Some of those will be done directly by the Department of Education. Others, districts will be able to apply to directly on their own to Washington for the grant. But in essence, for the large undesignated chunk of the federal stabilization money, it's my understanding that the House targets have used all $817 million of that for matching the targets where they're currently set at.
So, Mr. Strom, you don't see, we'll ask Ms. Weber too, but you're not seeing that we have any room in this committee to have any funding to allocate for projects such as Representative Swales' bill.
Madam Chair, I think there's a couple of issues here. On the direction that the Department of Education receives from the legislature about how to apply for grants and how to dispose of those grants, I believe there is some role that the legislature could play. There may not be enough information yet to know that, but for example, if the legislature were to direct the department to apply for a grant for a teacher training program or some other program like that, my guess is that the department would have to then craft their grant to fit that legislation. This, to the extent that this is a capital project, I'm not sure which of the grant funds would allow capital projects, and again, perhaps Ms. Weber will know whether there's any allowable capital uses there. But certainly on the programmatic front, if the legislature were to direct the department in terms of the grant writing, then I would expect that the legislature could have some say about that.
Thank you very much. Ms. Weber.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Michelle Weber with the Minnesota Department of Education. And Mr. Strum is correct. I will also take this opportunity to put in a little plug for the governor's supplemental budget, which also utilized all of the federal stabilization fund dollars, under which there were some general purpose funds that would have had some flexibility. However, those funds are allocated under the governor's proposal also. The special education funding and the Title I funding is both are formula funds that come to the Department of Education, and we essentially wave at them as they go by. There's a very specific formula that allocates those funds to school districts and charter schools throughout the state, and they have to be used for that, for the federal program in which they're authorized. The education technology funding, the state will be receiving those funds later this fall. It's been indicated in guidance we've seen so far that we will have to submit a plan. There is a formula that allocates the money to the state, so we do know how much we're getting on a statewide basis, but we will have to submit some information to the federal government for that. That is an existing program which allows states to allocate 50% of the funds on a formula basis to schools and 50% on a competitive basis, but they also have very specific funding purposes with respect to technology use. And the Head Start funding, that does not flow through the Department of Education. The Head Start funds go directly from the Federal Health and Human Services Agency to Head Start organizations in the state. I am not aware of any funding in the education portions of the economic stimulus package that could be used for capital projects. Under the federal stabilization funds, funding that school districts would get through our general education formula as proposed under the governor's budget, a school district then could elect to use those funds for some capital projects. That is one of the allowable usages of those dollars. There's also one pot of funding that's not indicated in here, and that would be the innovative funds. They are available to local education agencies to apply directly to the U.S. Department of Education, and specific guidance and parameters for those funds has not yet been received. So we'll have additional information from the U.S. Department of Education. But those are funds that local school districts would apply directly to the federal government for.
So, Ms. Weber, as far as Mr. Strom's comment that, you know, there could be programmatic grant applications where the legislature wouldn't be capital, but for program things, what would you see fitting into that category?
There are three categories of funding that would be available competitively to states that I'm aware of under the education provisions. One is the state incentive grant program, And with that program, any funding that a state receives, 50% goes out to school districts based on the Title I formula, and then 50% is utilized for the purposes of the grant application. We had, in discussions that we've been hearing from the U.S. Department of Education, they're encouraging states to partner together on initiatives under that, but we have not received any application materials or guidance about what types of things they'll be funding under that category. There's also longitudinal data system grants, which are, again, for a very specific purpose, to enhance a longitudinal data system. And then there is funding appropriated for the Teacher Incentive Fund, which is a competitive grant program for teacher training and so forth.
Okay, thank you very much. Representative Viskins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Swales, I'm intrigued by your funding source. However, there is another funding source out there that is fairly new to the state of Minnesota, and I wonder if you have attempted to tap that. I know, Madam Chair, you had said earlier one of we would both find very valuable in the new soil tax that's dedicated to the arts would be towards arts education. And using this stimulus dollars, which is a one-time appropriation, versus a sales tax, which is 20 years worth of revenue coming in, if we could set that paradigm that arts education is a valuable use of these dollars, so that'd be wonderful. And Representative Swales, you as a wonderful person could lead that charge in creating that paradigm. So I'm wondering, Representative, if you have and your organizations have moved forward on looking or approaching whatever committee does the allocation of the arts dollars from the state sales tax.
And Representative Wells, if you could do that as a wonderful person, there'd be another wonderful person right behind you, and I think we know who that might be. Let's consider that might be Representative Wells.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And as a matter of fact, we actually had this bill written so that it would go also to Mary Murphy, Chair Murphy's committee. We did not make the deadline for her committee, and so we're going to keep the bill alive for next year to follow that very track. But you are brilliant, and because of that, I will, in my best coloratura soprano voice, honor you with a solo one of these days. Maybe something from Oklahoma, like I'm just a girl who can't say no.
Representative Garofalo, and we are going to end this hearing in about 2 minutes so we get to the last bill. So we may not get to all the questioners if we take too long. Representative Garofalo.
Madam Chair, Ms. Weber, I just want to be clear. The special education funding, you described it as you kind of wave by as the money goes by. My recollection on this is that for the school districts to accept this money, we have this maintenance of effort stuff where they can't cut it in the future. Is that still true, or has anything changed with that, with the special education money?
Madam,
it's a local decision whether to take that money.
Ms. Weber.
Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo, it is a local decision whether or not to take the money. The maintenance of effort requirement is with respect to state and local funds. There is some flexibility that they can use the increase in special education funding, 50% of it, to meet some of their local requirements. And we, Dr. Meltzer was on a conference call with OSEP, the Office of Special Education Programs, last week to get more information about the maintenance of effort requirements and what types of flexibility there might be with the 50% rule dollars, which gets very technical very quickly, but so we are still sorting through some of the technicalities with that. If I may, Madam Chair, I also would just like to point out something that I made a statement about before. In the stabilization funds, one of the allowable usages is for school construction. However, the law specifically prohibits stadiums and so forth, so I don't know in this case if this would be viewed as a stadium, but just thought that I should point that out.
Thank you very much. Representative Ward, you're going to be the last questioner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll be real quick. Ms. Weber, in one of the committees or the other committees that I sit in, I heard a deputy commissioner from DHS say that instead of recovery money, if the legislature decided where that money was going to go, it would trump other formats of how the money is going to be distributed. So would that be true of the Department of Ed as well?
Ms. Weber.
Madam Chair, Representative Ward, it would still have to be within the allowable use and parameters of the program. So, for example, with Title I, those funds flow directly to school districts based on a formula. The legislature couldn't say, we're not going to fund those dollars to districts. We're going to appropriate them for this the purpose of this bill. Something like that could not take place.
But, Ms. Weber, if it were the incentive fund, longitudinal data, or teacher incentives, then would Representative Ward's question be accurate? Ms. Weber.
Madam Chair, the legislature could designate that we need to include that in our application, and then once the federal regulations came out, if it was allowable, then the state would include it in their application.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Swales, and to your testifiers from the Arts Connection, and House Bill 981 will be laid over for possible, House Bill 2183 will be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Representative Bly has House File 981, and I will move that for possible inclusion. And welcome to Representative Bly.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'm here to present a bill that is a partner with a bill that you passed earlier from Representative Benson called New Schools Minnesota. And what this bill would do is, and I understand I have only a short amount of time, but what this bill would do is establish a commission that would support efforts like Representative Benson's bill and also charter schools and other alternative or innovative programs and be something that would be set aside from government but would still be answerable to the legislature. And the purpose really is to, in some cases, attract foundation money or to find ways to study, research, provide assistance and help through information or guidance to schools that are trying to find innovative ways of solving some of the problems that we have in meeting the needs of students and understanding how to better serve our educational system.
And Justin Bly, you have an amendment. Would you
yes, I do.
Move that? I'll move the A090313 amendment. Representative Bly.
Yes, and this amendment helps put the bill in the the language that that we want, and also is something that we worked with the department on, so the department now supports the bill, and appreciate that very much.
Very good. Any questions on the amendment? Seeing none, all in favor of the A090313 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion passes. The amendment is adopted. We have, I don't see anybody that is asking a question. Is there one person from the audience that would like to say anything on the bill?
I just wanted to add to that we're actually not asking for any funding in this bill, although there would be some kind of pass-through money from the federal government for the assessment of the charter schools. But Morgan is here, and I'm sure I would be happy to say something
about the bill.
Madam Chair, Morgan Brown with the Education Department. Very quickly, just wanted to thank Representative Bly for working with us on this legislation and including the amendment that was just passed to respond to some of the department's concerns. On behalf of the department, I do want to speak in favor of the bill. We find that the research that has been done on how to create innovation in other sectors to be pretty compelling, and this is an attempt to bring that research to the education sector as well. The department views this bill as having a complementary or collaborative role with the department in that the commissioner retains all the current legal authority she has, but this entity would essentially help us with implementation of things such as Representative Benson's proposal regarding innovative schools, new schools within the district sector, Representative Slocum's bill on charter schools and strengthening authorizing for charter schools, that this would be an entity that could be actually of help to the department in its advisory role to the commissioner. And also that it really would help address something that's gotten a lot of discussion recently, which is breaking down the silos in our public education system and getting more direct discussion and exchange between the district sector and the charter sector in terms of replicating high-quality school models and effective practices. So for all those reasons, we really think this would be a step in the right direction. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions from members? Representative Bly, closing statement.
If you're looking for a model of kind of how this works, the Serve Minnesota
organization, nonprofit organization, is similar to what this would do, in that it does provide for a way to allocate money from AmeriCorps programs, and this would be a similar thing to that effect. I'm just really happy to be bringing this bill forward, having been a teacher for 30 years and lots of experience in innovation and seeing the positive things that can add to our school program. So very happy to present the bill to you.
Thank you very much. And House File 981 will be laid over, as amended, will be laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you both very much. Members, the pages are now going to be passing out an amendment that I just want to call to your attention. It is school boiler operator amendment language, and we don't have the bill in our committee that this might be amended onto, possibly on the floor or in another committee. There was a bill that included some of this, and it was taken out due to concerns, but now it's still floating about. And so since this is our last hearing before we have our omnibus bill, I just wanted to point it out to people. It was put into Senate File 1189 when that bill was heard in the Senate Education Committee, and we did not have this the companion bill for this here in our committee. It's in the Commerce Committee, but just because it may be coming up in another committee, I wanted to call it to the members' attention, and then I think is SEIU here that would like to testify, just so we know if you could come forward, and so we could know what this is about and not have to be blindsided when we get around to wherever this might show up. And so welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself.
Thank you, Madam members. I'm Joshua Ewes. I'm with SEIU. And like you said, we really are here because we wanted to stay in the good graces of the Education Committee. Basically, what this would do is make sure that junior boiler engineers are getting time in the boiler room, learning about boilers. School custodians are kind of in a unique position. If you're working in an industrial boiler plant, or if you're working for housing authority of some type, your job is to operate the boiler until you see the boiler. School custodians, because of the multifaceted nature of their job, don't necessarily get into the boiler room, and so oftentimes it falls on the chief or the first-class engineer, whoever the building supervisor is, to be operating the boiler all the time, or to have, you know, the primary jurisdiction of the boiler. And so basically what we're asking now is for the chief and the first to take the junior engineers into the room for a minimum of 2 hours and show them the ins and outs of the boiler. We think this is going to lead to a lot more efficient boilers, which, you know, in a big high school with $1 million heating budget for the year could save tens of thousands of dollars. I think that's the gist of it. If anyone has questions, I'd be glad to answer them.
Any questions from members?
We have a minute, Chair.
Captain Frappolo.
Madam Chair, and Secretary, so this is for public school students who want to have this as a profession? This is a
This is for
right.
Public school custodians who hold a special engineer's license or a second-class engineer's license. Any school custodian who's operating a boiler has to be licensed to operate the boiler. So what's happening is school custodians are getting licensed so that they can be in the building, but they're not actually getting the training in the boiler.
And I'm no expert on boiler training or boilers, but why would school districts be any different than other buildings across the state with boilers?
Because there's multiple employees in the building at a time, the knowledge doesn't necessarily get passed down. Back when it took more than one person to operate a boiler, the senior engineer would take the junior engineer down and they would do it together. Now it only takes one person to operate a boiler, so if there's five people in the building, there's maybe only one person who's really qualified to operate that boiler.
And we have Ms. Kelleher, if you'd like to come forward and give us your testimony. Is there anyone else that wants to comment? Okay, Ms. Kelleher.
Madam Chairman and members, we have concerns about this. We're really interested in safe boilers, and we've been trying to work this out with SEIU. We're worried that this would create an additional mandate and additional funding requirements on districts. And even though it's a small amount, we are concerned about it. This is normally training they get outside the school day presently. And we want to meet requirements everywhere else. So we're just worried once again about adding another mandate to the list in a year of extreme funding pressure.
And is this paired back from the when you two started the conversation, Mr. Whitney Way?
Thank you, Madam Chair. We think that this language that came out of the Senate Education Committee solves a lot of those problems. It's that the district will allow the training to take place, so there's no requirement on the district to be providing the training. Also, we've been talking to school custodians. Everyone thinks they can fit this into normal hours. In regards to training outside, you can take a community college class. You can buy a $500 book, but that does not put you in the boiler room. It just puts you in the classroom. And as Senator Sharon said in the Senate, she has done, authored enough boiler legislation that she can probably get her special engineer's license, but you don't really want her to go into the boiler room.
And the two bills that, the one that matches up with the Senate bill is Representative Gunther's bill, just for members' knowledge, mm-hmm. and then the bill that it might go on to is Representative Mahoney's bill, and I think the two of them are working together. Ms. Kelleher, it looks like you wanted to say one more thing.
Madam Chairman, we still have concerns about the bill. It would require 8 hours of training per year, and we've, Representative Mahoney asked the Department of Education for a fiscal note, so we're just sort of waiting to see on that.
Very good. So now, members, we know about this issue. If it crops up somewhere, we have a working knowledge, and we'll take a look at the fiscal note and keep the dialogue going. And if it could be worked out so we don't have anything to deal with, like the Thiessen bill, we'd be thrilled. But if not, we know at least what's going on. So thank you both.
Thank you.
And, members, the meeting is adjourned. Have a nice spring break.